Good evening, America, and good morning, good afternoon, Australia, rather. Welcome to all of you listening live. This is live streaming to LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook. Welcome to everyone who's listening today. You're with Tony Lontis, and this is Radio Tony Everyday Business, and with our special co-host, Christine Stowe. Now, just a quick reminder, if you want to find out any information about the show, please jump on to radiotony.com, where you will see all the information that leads directly to our amazing co-hosts with any offers that they might have and any of our downloads. So that's radiotony.com. You can also friend us on Facebook. Radio Tony has its own Facebook page, and you can find us on YouTube, Pinterest, LinkedIn, and Twitter. So that's about covers us for the social media wrap up this morning. Now, I have with me a very excited Christine Stowe, but before I introduce you to her, I need to tell you about this amazing woman. Now, Christine is a speaker, author, and community consultant. Christine found out something was wrong with her little baby daughter at 3 months of age, she had to reinvent herself. Since then, she's been elected to council, written her own story, completed an MBA, established support programs, and a special school. From lab tech to sales to carer to counsellor, she now speaks to women to help them find their passion, uncover their purpose, and turn it into business gold, supporting women to be empowered to make a contribution while working around their unique responsibilities to realise their true value. Christine likes to say life is about choices. You choose how you live each and every day. She chooses to wake up and live the best life she can. She wakes up grumpy every day at what life has thrown her, then with Imogen's disabilities, or she can wake up and embrace each day for the wonderful day that it gives. It does not make a difference if Imogen is sad or happy, so she might as well be happy and make the best of her life. She will not be defined by Imogen's disabilities. So, Christine, good afternoon and welcome to Radio Tony.
Yeah, good afternoon and good evening to the listeners in the USA.
I've been particularly excited to have Christine on the show since she first agreed to co-host with me. She has an amazing story, and I thought today that the best way to start is start at the beginning. So, Christine, tell me about you and your life up until this point. So what was growing up like? What was early adult life like?
So we're going to need more than one show for all of that, obviously.
I know. Lucky we have more than one show, though. Hey.
That's right. So I grew up in Epping, so that's where I live now, in the northern outskirts of Melbourne, and it was semi-rural, if you like. And looking out, you know, my parents had acreage, and I used to say I live on the edge of reality, was the edge of Melbourne. But my parents were a business from home, and that's significant because I think that it's shaped a lot of how I think and how I work now. So they ran a business from home, and we had their employees would come and eat breakfast at our table with us. So that's how my parents had people coming and going all the time, you know, ran their business, and they always treated people well, and I think that that's really important. So from there I went to local primary school and then away to a private girls' school. That also shapes how I think.
Yes.
Went on to study Bachelor of Science because that's what our headmistress said everyone should study science. So I did science, and then I got a job in forensic science and testing drugs and blood alcohol.
Mm.
So that was interesting and I loved it. But I realised that I wanted to help people. So I decided,
yes.
I was terribly shy. I didn't talk to anyone.
Yes.
But I wanted to help people. I wanted to help scientists and laboratory people. So I decided I wanted to get into sales. So I felt that being here in Melbourne would keep me in a laboratory box. So I decided I'd go to Queensland because I was spending money on science and technology.
So yes.
Back then we didn't have, this was last century, right? we didn't have something called the internet. So I decided I'd apply for jobs in Queensland, and what I had to do back then was to get a newspaper from Queensland. So I got the local news agent to fly up a copy of the newspaper, Queensland newspaper, to apply for jobs. And that's also significant because I think that even then, before I'd done coaching or before I found out some, you know, before this life, if you like, I decided that this is where I wanted to get to.
Yes.
And took the steps to get there. And I think that's significant. It, you know, thinking back, now you just Google it, right? But I took extraordinary steps. I remember driving down every Monday to the news agent. When I think back now, I think, what was I thinking? But, you know, this is what I did every week. And then I couldn't actually get something without being in Queensland. So I saved up all my money and moved to Queensland. And then I was up there and I was applying for jobs, and I was offered a couple of different jobs. And I say that applying for a full-time job is a full-time job.
Yes.
You have to be committed to what you're doing. So I was committed and I got a job. Eventually I got a job in sales, and I was pretty quickly made state manager up there. So it was wonderful. Like, Queensland's wonderful.
Yes, well, I think I'm pretty partial to Queensland as well, but I do like Victoria and Melbourne, I have to say, and I have missed Melbourne this year in particular, because listeners, just retrospectively, or just speaking, Melbourne in Australia is in Victoria, which is the southern states, and poor old Melbourne has been in one of the world's toughest lockdowns for, was it about three months, Christine, that you guys were in lockdown?
From July to...
It was a long time.
So it was three, four months.
Yeah. So normally I would fly multiple times to Melbourne for conferences or getaways or business, and I haven't been there once this year, and I have to say I miss it. That's all there is to it. So anyway, this is where Christine lives now. Sorry, I digress. Back to your story. You were living in Queensland and you applied for jobs the old-fashioned way.
but look, Queensland's beautiful. I love Queensland. The weather up there is good, and it lends itself to a great lifestyle. But for Melbourne's got a different personality, I think. I remember living in Queensland, and it had this wonderful weather where, but people weren't taking advantage of it. Like down in Melbourne, I remember coming back to Melbourne, it was 13 degrees, and people were sitting outside drinking coffee, but they didn't do that in Queensland.
Yeah, yeah. If it's 13 degrees in Queensland, everyone thinks it's just cold. But I love the cold weather. So if it's cold in Queensland, I'm happy.
Yeah. So the personality of Melbourne, I think, is like different. We've got a different perspective. We've got a lot of European influence. So different delightful foods, that sort of thing. So Queensland was great.
Yes.
And then I met my now ex-husband up there. And I came back to Melbourne to be with my family and have kids, which was great. We were renovating an inner city dump. It was a dump. It was a double-fronted big garden. We had no bathroom at one stage, and they had the gas explosion. We had no hot water. And I'd fallen pregnant. So it's quite a story, renovating this house. And, you know, double fronted, white picket fence, everything was perfect. And I'd been made national technical advisor for a medical company, which was absolutely where I wanted to be. I was swanning around the world advising doctors and nurses on our products, and had my second daughter. I was all set to go back. Everything's perfect, loving husband, renovating the house, as you do. And then found out there was something. And I still get emotional when I recount the story. I took I'd taken Imogen, so that's my second daughter, to the child and maternal health nurse, and she said she's not meeting her milestones. And the bottom just fell out of my world. It was a grey and overcast day, and I remember just not knowing what was next. That was like the end of my life. Totally bottom fell out of my world. So that was tough. That was really tough. And then time went on.
She was about 3 months old, was she?
She was 3 months, So so you go to the child and maternal health nurse a number of times, and then, I could see that the child and maternal health nurse was working really hard on her this day, and she, you know, they'd follow a toy and she wasn't following the toy. And you couldn't make all these excuses like, oh, it'll be all right, she doesn't feel like it today. And then she turned around and said, and you've got to see a pediatrician. So then I felt we got on this merry-go-round. It's like a merry-go-round, round and round, like I couldn't get off. And I go here, go here, go here. And I counted at one stage we had 12 health professionals, 12. Involved in her care. So, you know, there was occupational therapist, physiotherapist, speech therapist. At one stage, somebody said to her father, she's 3 months old, why has she got a speech therapist? Like, is she talking already? The mouth movements and, you know, making sure she can chew and that sort of thing. So seeing all these health professionals and para health professionals, and, you know, I was depressed. I fell into depression.
Yes.
And I remember, you know, you get assigned a social worker, and they said at the time, they said, we're really worried about you. And I remember my Imogen has a muscle condition. So she hasn't been 100% diagnosed, but it's most like a muscle condition, so it makes her muscles stiff. I've got an older daughter as well, Maria, so she's 18 months older. And I remember Imogen would be having seizures. So, you know, she's got epilepsy. So she'd be having seizures. And so she'd go into this, the first I noticed, she just went into this kind of frozen state. And I took her to see the doctors a couple of times. I said, we don't know, you know, we have to diagnose, we have to do tests. But, you know, they couldn't see it. Like I couldn't get her to the doctor when it was happening. So she had to have probes on her head and everything. But I remember my older daughter coming back to me one day, like Imogen was in the cot, and my older daughter coming back to me and she said, Mummy, Imogen, do this. So she was having a seizure. So, so you know, so it has an impact on siblings as well.
Did Imogen have the seizures before the maternal health nurse said that things are not right? So she'd been having, so you thought you already had an inclination that something was not quite right?
I did pretty much from the start because she was she was jumpy. But it wasn't like, you know, child maternal health nurse came at 3 days and I said, well, she's jumpy. And they said, oh, no, she'll settle down in a, you know, in time. Right. She'll settle down. Mm-hmm. But she was very jumpy. So I guess you have an inkling in the back of your mind. The other thing is that
but
she's
you don't want to.
Yeah. Beautiful baby, you know. The first one was, you know, you don't know what you're doing. And the second one, this is going to be right. I've got this, you know.
Yes.
It didn't turn out that way.
Yes. But, yes.
When I brought my older daughter home, you know, put her into the car seat, she just kind of flopped into place. When I went to put, in retrospect, thinking about Imogen, when I put her in the car seat, she was a bit harder to get the car seat on. Okay. And then before the child and maternal health nurse had said that, I recall her being difficult to dress, like she's stiff.
Okay.
You have to put her clothes on and things like that. So in retrospect, there were signs, but you don't.
Yes, but you don't. Yeah.
So that was.
And so Christine, have they got a name for the muscular issue that Imogen has?
So it's called Swartz-Jampel syndrome. So it's a genetic
Okay,
thing.
yes.
The muscles are stiff, and Swartz and Jampel were the two guys that identified this condition. So with those stiff muscles, the first thing, her finger, the thumb's sort of stuck in her hands like that.
Yes.
She couldn't pick things up. But it affects all sorts of things, like in the mouth for chewing, and so she doesn't speak.
Yeah.
She's 20 now, and she doesn't
Yes,
speak.
yes. Oh. Is she still at home, Christine?
Yes, she is. Yes, yeah, she's here with me now.
So she's still.
Yeah,
yes.
She's watching TV. Yeah, she doesn't walk or talk, but she's the boss of the house.
Yes, fair enough.
And if she doesn't like it, she's like, but you know.
Oh. So going back to that diagnosis, young mum, your older daughter, and then you've got this beautiful little baby with these issues and the backwards and forwards to medical professionals and trying to get that sorted. That's an exhausting treadmill to be on, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. And as I was saying, it affects the siblings as well. And back then,
yes,
we were going to hospitals and I could get support, and it hasn't changed, actually. I could get support for Imogen, but I couldn't get support for my older daughter. So, you know, my older daughter could spell, pediatrician before she was four, seeing all these health professionals. And I was at that stage trying to get care for my older daughter so that I could go to the hospital, but the care is only available for Imogen. So my older daughter got carted around a lot as part of that process, but it also affects the older child, because if you can imagine, if you've got siblings, you get to interact with your siblings. So I noticed that my older daughter didn't get to play make-believe or work some of those things out that you do with normal siblings. So that's one of the first impacts, I think. And there's other impacts, as they grow up, they're not growing at the same rate.
Yes.
And also when my older daughter got to be a teenager, she was a bit more held back, if you like, because, I couldn't just go and take her where she needed to be to hang around with other kids. My older daughter would go to a sibling group, and she said that the kids at school don't understand. She said, but these kids in the sibling group understand. It's like normal to them.
They get it.
They get it. It's like, hanging around with other parents that get it.
Yes.
You can't get it unless you get it.
So
that was a journey. So from there, it was, the social worker said at one stage, you're very worried about me. I remember being upset and crying over Imogen.
Yes.
The social worker coming and saying, she's looking at you going, what's wrong, mummy? what? So she can perceive things. I had somebody visit me one day. She was looking at this guy like, you're a stranger. Like, what are you doing in my house? So she sees everything.
It's a perception.
With her facial expressions. Yeah. So then time went on, and I figured that I'd want to find a way. I was going to get back into the workforce. My background had been science, national technical advisor. I couldn't go back and do that because had all the caring. I had to cancel the care that I had. But on the other hand, I think that having Imogen allowed me to stop and smell the roses. So I was on the corporate trajectory. This was everything I thought life was meant to be, but then I had to stop. And I think that it's a blessing, because I was able to then stay at home with the children. Like I wasn't then, putting them in care and racing off to work. So I think it's a blessing. I got to meet people that you wouldn't meet otherwise, you know, very wonderful people in, you know, disability.
Compassionate. And
So Imogen got an interchange family. So that's a family that looks after her. They would look after her one weekend a month from when she was.
Oh, yay.
It's funny, you know, the people that most help are the ones that have most on their plate, if you like. So this mum had five kids of her own, one adopted and two Down syndrome that she also cared for. And then she had Imogen. Mm-hmm. So
wow.
So we're still part of their family, if you like. We still see them and Imogen. Too big now to have there, but it's funny how people who, you know, the most caring kind of thing, you know, that have the most on their plate. So
do you get respite care now that Imogen's older? Just I'm wondering about the continuity from, you know, child to adult, because it changes. They still need care, but obviously they no longer go to that family situation. So do you have a respite family, or how does that work now, Christine?
So now, fortunately, NDIS has rolled in. So Imogen.
Ah, yes, yes.
So I don't get respite. And there was a whole thing about when NDIS rolled in.
Yes.
People, you know, carers are like, oh, we're not getting respite. We're not being looked after. But it's Imogen's being looked after, not me. So for me, that's better because to care for her. It's not easy, by the way, but better.
Yeah, yeah.
She goes to a day program. She goes away. Yeah, she goes away on camps. And, again, it's not easy for me to let her go.
Oh, absolutely. That was my first thought. How do you do that? How do you let her go to a camp?
There's a lot of paperwork and a lot of organising to do, and sometimes I think it's not worth it. I don't want to send her, and once she's away, I'm always like holding my breath.
Yes. Yes.
But the last couple of times I've been to pick her up, there's other clients there, and they go, "Oh, Imogen." Maybe not during COVID, but you know, and then it's like, that makes it all worth it, you know, like she's there having fun with other people, and they're like, oh, Imogen, you know, and she's got, you know, some friends. She goes to a respite house. She's got some friends there that do the same, that just push her around in the wheelchair. I've got lots of stories to tell. When she was at primary school, they used to just go one day a week to the local normal primary school and be in the class, and the normal kids, there was seven of them, so there was five boys with autism and two girls in a wheelchair, and the local normal kids would push them around in the wheelchair, or they'd chase the children with autism around, and they had to behave. They had to be really good to be allowed to go into this special classroom. So they were all like, you know, so it's beautiful.
Yes.
Beautiful to see these kids, you know, working together and chasing these boys around with autism.
That's fantastic.
Nice to see them in that setting. So time went on anyway, you know, and I decided that I wanted to use the skills and abilities that I had. I felt a bit ripped off because of a Bachelor of Science, postgraduate certificate in engineering and technology management. So I looked around for where I could get back into work, and I took a role as coordinator for Northern Region Disability Network because I wanted to learn about disability. I wanted to learn about what services we have. I didn't know anything about disability. And, you know, you spend time, right? You know, I would look at people and say, you know, going through this with Imogen, that's not me. But no. You know, this is where, you know, that's them.
Yes.
But we're going to get out of this. And then, you know, there comes a time when I guess you accept it. So I accept it and then took a role at Northern Region Disability Coordinator. And from there, I learned about disability services, but there was an organisation, some people setting up a political party in 2006. on disability issues, and they targeted me to stand for them because I had all those contacts in northern metropolitan regions. So that was a game changer, and we were campaigning on what is now NDIS, which is National Disability Insurance Scheme. So for people who are not in
How
Australia,
wonderful.
that's a support service that we have to support the person with a disability. It's called National Disability Insurance Scheme. So we were the forerunner of the, before it rolled in, that's what we were campaigning on. So when it actually rolled in, I was quite familiar with it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And like I say, I was thinking, no, this isn't meant to be me. I suffer from depression, anxiety, all those things. What do you mean? And then they asked me to stand in the state election, and I went, well, I've been trained to speak in public from my medical sales. I've got a Bachelor of Science, so I'm pretty rational.
Qualified.
Yeah, and I can speak for these people. And I went, hang on a minute, it's so meant to be me. So that was a game changer, I guess. But from there, that's when I decided that it was hard work. I was never, ever going to get politics again. It's too hard. But I also, at that's when I thought to myself, I can wake up happy or I can wake up sad. It's not going to make any difference to Imogen. I might as well wake up the best that I can be. And
Absolutely.
that came out of standing in the state election. So, and I also decided at that stage that I would get the supports that I needed to do whatever I had to do with Imogen, not to make a fight of it. Because if you make a fight, if you make something a fight, that's tiring.
Yes,
So I just
absolutely.
decided what I needed and took the steps. Again, the same thing that I did when I was in forensic science and wanted to get out. This is where I want to get to. And I didn't get caught up in the bushfires around me, I guess. It's just this is what I need and this is what I get. I did. Prior to standing in the state election, I was writing letters to MPs. I was, protesting in the streets, speeches on the steps of Parliament, all but tying myself to trees.
There's nothing wrong with tying yourself to a good tree.
No, there's not. But what I noticed was I could do all that stuff and it didn't make one iota of difference. What makes the difference? Actually being at the table. So I decided it was hard work, tiring, never going to do it again. And then in 2012, some people asked me to stand in the council election, and I did. It is actually sitting at the table that you get to have an influence on those decisions. So I think all this experience leads me to say we need more of us to be sitting at that table.
Absolutely. Christine, what was the difference between state politics and local politics for you? Was state politics your ability to have a bigger voice versus local politics, smaller voice, or were they just completely different? I'm curious.
State politics, it was a political party set up on disability issues. So we had that kind of big, grand
Yes, great big.
impact, if you like. We didn't actually get anyone elected, but we were there to stand. So when you see different parties stand on different issues and people say, oh, they're just a one party issue, or, they're just about animal rights, or, it actually makes a difference because it gives people that voice. So that was us. So then when it came to local government, I said, at first I said I was never going to do it again. And then somebody asked
I
me,
know.
okay.
I
And I was like, all right. So I did. And again, it was about having that voice. And I thought to myself, I'm never going to stand in local council. Like, that's just about bitching, infighting, and backbiting. I don't want to be involved in that, petty fighting. And they asked me to stand. I didn't expect to get elected, and I got elected. And I got to the table, and it was all that I thought, pity, backbiting, infighting. But sitting at the table,
Oh,
I mean, again, I didn't get engaged in that stuff. So sitting at the table, I was able to have an impact. That's where I got a special school set up, and that's where I got a cafe for people with disabilities. So where I said we need to be sitting at the table, I was sitting at the table.
It allows.
Have an impact. And the council, as I said before, it was a very acrimonious council. It was very, sided.
Yes.
But they said to me, anything you want, we will back you because we know that you know what you're talking about. So, you know, when I come to the table with the special school, you know, like they were just, how do we get this done? How do we get this done?
Amazing. So, amazing.
We do need to be sitting at the table. But, you know, having said all of that, I made amazing friends.
Yes.
And had amazing things come out of it. People that I didn't think, you know, made friends across the board. And what you see in state politics or federal politics and you see them fighting or whatever, you still have to get together to get stuff done.
Yeah.
So you still have to, you know, if you're just fighting all the time, you don't get it done. So, but I was able to talk to them all and get stuff done. So what you see on the TV or whatever, there's a lot of stuff where politicians come together to get those bigger things done.
Yeah. That's actually encouraging to know, because from the outside looking in, all they look like they do is fight and try to score political points against each other. And I feel like putting them in a ring like 2-year-olds and going sort it out. And when you come back, let's get some stuff done. That's what Australian politics looks like to me from the outside looking in. But it's good to hear that they actually get stuff done. That's good to know.
Well, I'm still involved in politics, and I'll say now that it's not not like that. That's what you see on the TV, and that's how the media promotes it. But knowing, like I know, you know, personally the MPs, and I think the things that people say about them, I think that no matter which side you're on, they're there for the good of the people. They are. They just think about things from a different perspective, but they're all there for it's a tough one. It's a tough gig.
Oh,
so I think that we need to pay them the respect that they're due. It's, you know, I worked in an MP's office and they're, you know, on call 24/7. Their life is.
Yes, they work lots.
Yeah, and no amount of money can really account
compensate.
For that. Yeah, compensate. Yeah. You know, their families are sometimes drawn into it. So I think that we need to respect them. And we need to respect that it's a process. And both sides are there for good of the people, so we need to allow them to do that. So I got elected to council, and I had, again, by this stage my now ex-husband had left. So we worked through.
Christine, sorry, lovely. The reason he left, difficulty dealing with Imogen's diagnosis, or was it other things?
No, it was other things. It was other things. And I don't like to say it's dealing with Imogen's disability. Maybe that had something to do with it. But I don't think that's fair on Imogen, because her responsible, but he had his
and pain. She's not.
No, she's not responsible. It just is how it is. But, you know, by now he'd left, and so I then was elected to council, and a decision to make. How was I going to do this? Oh, my God.
That's my first thought. Yay, you got elected to a council. Hubby's just left. You've got the beautiful Imogen and a younger daughter. How do you make that work? Oh, my God.
That's right. And the funny thing was, we kind of anticipated that it was going to happen, as in the other council and myself. And Imogen had major surgery coming up. She had a rod put in the back because she was.
Oh, no.
So
yes.
So the VEC rang me. So they're the people who organised the countbacks, which it was a countback.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And said, oh, you know, so there's going to be a count back on this day. And I said, that's no problem. Imogen has to go to hospital. But it's only, they're only going to clean her teeth. And they'd sent me the wrong letter. And she was going to be, had this rod put in her. back.
She was, that's she had, terrible.
She had a rod put in her back. She was in intensive care.
Yes, it's a big deal.
Big deal. And she came out of intensive care and then she crashed again and she was back in intensive care. And, you know, at the end of the 2 weeks, and she was still in hospital when they had the when they had the count back. So I had somebody, I had the interchange mum come and sit with her and drove out to the council and I got elected. So then I had the decision to
move.
Yes, so came out and I got elected. And then it was like back in hospital. Now what? Like, I've been elected to council. I had some reporters ring me to ask me about it, but I was like, you know, here I am sitting in the hospital again.
Looking after Imogen.
Yeah. So then Imogen came out of hospital and she had care. But at this time, I was like, this is an opportunity. People have voted for me to stand and I take my place at the table because I'd be letting them down if I didn't. So how was I going to do that? So I just thought I'll just throw everything at it that I possibly can, whatever I have to do. I didn't know what that was going to look like.
So,
so I took the opportunity and took my place at council. So I organised to get support workers and I just thought I'd do the minimum that I possibly could. But as time went on, I got more used to it, I guess. But when you ask about do I have respite, I feel like that was a practice run or, you know, it made me get support workers. I had to. Whereas before, before I got elected to council, I probably wouldn't have left her for more than 2 hours at a time. So we like running here, running here, running back.
Running
all around Imogen. But it made me have to get support workers and have to work around her care. So NDIS wasn't a thing at that time.
No.
But it was like a practice run. Yeah. So I think
amazing. So we talked about your career as a national sales manager for medical devices and traveling all the world, Imogen. What made you think and getting into council and then so what made you think about going from that to your career in coaching? What was the pivotal moment that led to that decision?
I knew that I had a pathway where I had overcome significant challenges, you know, firstly Imogen and standing in the state election, kind of things that not many other people have done as full-time
carer,
and being elected to council, and people were often asking me how I achieved this or how I did that. So I wanted to be able to help other women in my position. I don't want another woman to feel like they have to, you know, in a caring position or, you know, with disability or at the end of their career, perhaps, you know, they're being made redundant, something like that. I don't want another woman to feel like that's the end of their life or to be defined by that. I know that I have the ability to light the pathway for other women. So I did a coaching course so that I could formally do that with other women. So that's what led me to that, because I want other women to, you know, I say I won't be defined by Imogen's disability. You know, and I want other people to know that they don't have to be defined by the challenges that they're faced with.
Do you think that I had a conversation this morning with my first co-host and we were talking about a lot of things, but one of those were around male and female roles. Now, it's my understanding that many, many women are the sole carer for their child or young adult with disabilities. Do you see that changing with support of NDIS, or do you think that's one of those things that's going to remain with the mums in the stories?
It depends if we're talking about the mums or if we're talking about support workers. So if we talk about carers as the carers, family carers and support workers in the industry, I had a conversation with somebody last week former principal of a special school, and talking about having male teachers. Now, Imogen had some male support workers at the school, but he said that, and it's the same here, I have all female support workers and I'm not comfortable having a male support worker. So I think as far as males go caring for, so women can care for males or females. Men put themselves at risk for caring for for girls. So I think that that's one of the things.
Part of the problem.
That it remains mainly a woman's role as a support worker. As a carer, I swapped roles with my ex at different stages, and he stayed home and looked after both my older daughter and Imogen. And I think that they both benefit from that, both the child and and him, because they bring something different to the table.
Yes.
But I think as women, and this is what I say about we need to identify our fault, I think that we need to step over that. We do a lot of giving away our gifts, and I think that I think we need more, you know, we need more male teachers, we need more male support workers, because as male people, children with disability, with behavioural issues, and we need more males in the in the field. But it's also difficult with that sexual thing.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no, I agreed. It's a wonderful conversation to have heading into 2021, the whole idea of gender and gender stereotypes, because whilst it's very important, particularly with women and young women with disability, that they have access to female carers, we still need to build that, continue to build care into male roles as well, because males can be incredibly caring and supportive. It's not the sole role of females, except in those circumstances where you're looking after young women and people, females with disabilities, because that's where it's important to have access to female support. I know that
it's important to have choice. I think it's important to have choice, but I think that men bring something wonderful to the role that we need to embrace, and we need to encourage it, absolutely.
Yes, yes. We need to have that more diversity across the support system that supports our people with disability. I want to ask about the NDIS, because it's kind of unique to Australia, and it's probably important that we talk about what it actually is for our American audience. I don't know that there's something quite the same in America, and I know that our NDIS, the National Disability Support Initiative, is pretty good, isn't it, Christine?
Yes, it is very good. So prior to NDIS rolling in, I got support to sit on council provided by the council, but outside of that, I could get 5 hours a month. 5 hours a month to go out, socialise with my friends. So that was when, back in the day, when it was supporting the carer, if you like. So now the support is around
it supports the person.
So as much as people, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, having the carer supported or the person supported. So that it has a package. So it's about her disability and it's about her.
Yes.
So our NDIS is about supporting the person to live as near a normal life as possible. So
they can.
I don't know that. I don't think that there's anything like that in the US. I don't know what else.
I'm pretty sure there's not.
So she's got a package to support her. So if I think about, it's not what I'm doing. So I used to have to write down everywhere I went. used to have to, think about, am I doing this? Am I going there? Are they paying that? Now it's about Imogen. So I think about what would it be like if she was normal, if my life was normal. So, and it's a significant package to support her. But I still think too that it's not easy if, if you're a carer, even if you're in Australia, it's not easy to hand over that care. So money's nice.
That was my next question. How do you, as her mum, who has been her single sole support person for so long, change into allowing the government, I guess, to determine what her best needs are and support her in that? How do you let go, Christine? As her mum, how do you let go?
That's where I say the council was good for me because that made me as I wouldn't, I'd run out and get shopping, run back, run out. I hadn't left her.
Yes.
Whereas I had to. So I had to plan and I had to think about what things can I get the support workers to do, because I think a lot of carers, if they're listening to this, will be saying, I can't do that. It really forced me to say, well, you'll have to feed her, I won't be here, you'll have to do this. Before that, I used to work everything around so that, and I used to have these support
workers. So you still did that.
These support workers used to come for 5 hours a month. I would feed her, change her, put her to bed, and they would sit on my couch and knit. So that I was doing handstands and backflips, pirouettes, so that they could sit on my couch and I'd be like exhausted.
And relax.
And I think that's it's not easy to do. It's not easy to hand it over. But I think that if there's anything that I can say for carers, you need to practice it.
Yes.
To make some of those hard decisions, and it's still not perfect.
But you get more of that. You get more of that help now, though, Christine. So you can actually leave and know that Imogen is fully cared for. You don't have to run around and do the meals and toileting and bedtime. You can just go and know that she's going to get the care that she deserves while you're with outside the house.
Yes, but it takes practice and it takes organisation. So as much as but within the NDIS, it's a lot more flexible. Mm-hmm. So I can get those workers to do more, whereas the other ones would come and just sit on my couch. But I'll just tell you a quick story about after I'd been elected to council and I went away to write my book. I went away to write the book.
Yes.
And I went away with Natasha Denman for the 48-hour author. So for a weekend, it's going to go away and write this book. And it was down the peninsula, so 2 hours out of Melbourne. And this was the first time that I'd left Imogen. So I'd been running around with council, just up the road if I needed to be. This was going away for a weekend, still in Melbourne. So I had everything organised. I had support workers come in for the weekend. I had everything laid out, the food, the medications, had a backpack on a wheelchair with a key to the house so they could get in the house. The support workers had been here. They knew where everything was. I'd been away for 2 hours and the support worker rang me and said, there's no key to get in the house. So everything was like planned, everything was, organised, but it fell over. So this is where I'm saying that you can organise and you can let go, but there's still things that can still happen. So I had a key hidden in the garden. So here I am on the phone, 2 hours away, trying to direct the support worker to where this key was in the garden. It's not there now, by the way. And it looked like she was never going to find it. Was I going to drive back? And next thing, the support worker goes, oh, your other daughter's here. It's like I was so focused on Imogen, I forgot I had another daughter. And she turned up with her key and threw into the house. As carers, we have backup plans to backup plans to backup plans. Like I also have my parents and I'd forgotten about my older daughter, and the siblings are so important.
Yeah, I was just going to say, in all of this, how does your older daughter cope with all of this, and how involved is she in Imogen's care?
So over the years, she's been very involved, and she would stay home and look after her at times. She's now moved out of home, and she said to me, "What do you think about moving out of home?" And I said, "I think that's a good idea because you get to spend time." Yeah, like I want her to have the best life that she possibly can, and I've done everything in my power to make her as resilient as I can, because one day she might have to make decisions for Imogen, and I need her to be the best that she can be. And they're more prone to mental health issues, drugs and alcohol. So I, you know, Imogen will be Imogen, but I need to make the daughter the best that she can be. So she's found it hard, and she doesn't have a sibling to have those normal relationships. And at some stage she might have to make decisions for her. So that's tough. Mm-hmm. So it's tough.
Yes.
She has been very involved in her care, but now she lives out of home, and I support her in doing that.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. We are down to the last 3 minutes, and I wanted to talk to you about Grants Made Easy and a few other things, but I think I'm going to park that for next week because I want to really delve into that whole discussion. But you've got a really powerful mission, and I actually think that this is a very beautiful way to round out the end of the show. So I want you to tell our audience about your beautiful mission, Christine.
So I have a mission to light the pathway for 1,000 women. I want women who feel they're not heard, they're overworked, underpaid, or they're dealing with a challenge like disability or caring, illness. I want them to know that they have a voice. I don't want them to be defined by the challenge that they think they are. So that's what I
want to help. Fantastic. And Christine, you also help women find their unique gifts and discover what they're passionate about, because your unique gifts and your passion are what will get you up in the morning.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm absolutely. I am like Christine, and I've battled with depression and anxiety, so I know what it feels like to struggle to get out of bed of a morning, but I can tell you the difference it makes when you discover something that you're passionate about, because that will get you up. No matter how low and bad you're feeling, that passion will drive you forward. So I'm really looking forward to getting into the whole discussion about passion, and passion in particular for women, in the upcoming weeks. Now, Christine, before we completely run out of time, I would like you to tell the audience how they can connect with you and your website, please.
Yeah, so my website is www.christinestowe.com.au, or they can contact me on Facebook, so Christine A. Stowe on Facebook. And I've got a link to my Magnetic Mindset Morning Ritual, or 25 no-cost, low-cost marketing ideas.
Fantastic. Now, guys, just for you listening, if you're looking for those links in particular, they'll be up on our website as well, radiotony.com, but go in the first instance to christinestowe.com.au, and you will find lots more information about Christine and what she does, which we will be delving into again. So Christine and I've got a show next week, and we're going to have a bit of a break over Christmas, and then we'll be back again with two more shows. So next week, I want to delve into, Christine wrote a wonderful program called Grants Made Easy. So we're going to delve into that next week, and further continue our conversation about women finding their passion and purpose, because that's an important conversation. And it's often at this time of year, at Christmas time, when people have a break, they have time to actually sit and think and wonder about these things. So it's an important conversation we'll come back to next week. Wonderful listeners, thank you everyone for joining us today. You've been listening live to Christine Stowe and Tony Lontas on Radio Tony Everyday Business. Christine Stowe, thank you so much for joining us this week. I can't wait to our further discussion next week, and tell our listeners all about more about what you do and what passion drives you. So Thanks, Christine. And TJ, that's it for us this week. I will talk to you again all soon. Bye for now.